from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on this morning's forum program, Fabiana Rodriguez's art is as colorful as it is political. She uses prints to speak out about immigration, women's rights, racism, and gentrification, among other issues, and she'll join us as part of our first-person series, which features local innovators, leaders, and notable characters who make the Bay Area unique. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. And in this hour, we welcome Oakland native, artist, political activist, and teacher Fabiana Rodriguez. As part of our ongoing first-person series, and that first-person series is set up, as many of you know, to feature local innovators, leaders, and notable figures who enhance the Bay Area and give it its unique character. And Fabiana is an artist and cultural organizer whose art actually deal with, well, migration, racism, women's rights, and many other topics. And she also directs Culture Strike, which is a national arts organization that engages artists, writers, and performers in migrant rights. 2009, she co-founded Presente.org, which is an organizing network that is aimed at empowering Latino communities. And you can find a KQED Arts video of Fabiana Rodriguez creating prints in her studio on our website, kqed.org/forum. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Pleased to have you here. And I actually saw an Instagram that you put out last night on your Instagram, and I'm going to just read it, and then we can maybe start talking from it. You said, "I'm in my studio framing things for my open studio with my crew, scarfing down a meal, checking Twitter to follow the protests. I'm reflecting on what being an artist means to me and how it has given me voice to offset the internal racism embedded in my brain since childhood. Art is resistance. Art is our ability to define our humanity on our own terms. Art is self-determination. Art is not enough to change the world, but it is indispensable."
Yes.
That's very well said.
Thank you.
And let's talk about art and activism, because these are the two things that you so much have tried to bring together in your adult life and the two things that you believe in fervently and champion and so forth. Where do they intersect and where do they bring about change?
Yes, I think that there's a magical and powerful intersection between culture and politics, and that is that there's people elected, our elected officials, that are in charge of designing policy every day. And it's our responsibility to pressure them, to call them, to really create an environment where they're accountable to us. And at the same time, often those tactics can be very short term. I think that we need to shift culture in order to shift politics. And if we look at, for example, marriage equality, there was culture happening years, almost 15 years before we had a win at the Supreme Court. For example, you had Ellen come out on TV. You had Rachel Maddow, Will and Grace. You had pop culture stories that were reflecting the humanity of the LGBT community. And likewise, that's what's needed. Culture and arts is needed in order to reflect our full humanity as people of color. Right now, the conversation is quite fitting because as we're witnessing the death and the murder of young black men throughout the country, it's important to also ask ourselves, well, how are black people depicted in the media, in pop culture, in film?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, when you talk about pop culture, are you talking about something different than art, which has a more hallowed meaning often associated with it?
Well, I think that art is an expansive thing, and I look at visual culture in particular. And my art is not just in museums or in galleries. My art is in the street, it's in classrooms, it's in community centers. And so I really think about the culture we're surrounded with every day and how that's shaped. And how is it that we can add complexity to our stories? So, for example, as a Latina growing up in the United States, I was born here. It's extremely rare for me to go to a movie theater and find films that show women like me, Latinas, women of color, as primary protagonists. And for that matter, it's extremely hard to find black women, Asian women. And that to me is institutionalized racism. And what I attempt to do through art and broadly through culture is to create positive and multidimensional images of those who are at the margins. It's not just around racism. It's also women. I mean, women are depicted in very narrow ways as well. In order for us to begin to shift our imagination and hence create policy wins in the future.
A lot of this, in my mind, now comes down to monarch butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's
yes.
become kind of a major symbol for you in terms of migration
yes.
and migrants. And it's getting the message out through the image, really, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And let's also think about, you know, what's embedded in our imagination. So I grew up in California, and I remember 1994, Governor Wilson, when he first introduced the first state-based anti-immigrant law here in California, he began that whole wave of governors doing that. But if you remember the images that were on TV, they were often depicting immigrants running across the border or in the trunks of cars. And it was a really fear. It was a message around fear that you don't want these people coming in. And that anti-migrant narrative was very successful in creating almost a bias. And so when we think of immigration, unfortunately, we make links in our imagination to criminal, to the idea that somehow migrants don't belong here, that they're outsiders, that they're here to take away. Right. And so my attempt with the monarch butterflies was to instead encourage our imagination to see the heroic aspect of what it means for someone to move. And also the immense amount of courage it takes. You know, my mom left her country of Peru when she was 18 years old, and she wasn't able to go back for at least 2 decades. And just imagine the courage it takes for someone to leave their family and go to another faraway place where you may not even know the language. You, if you're a woman trying to cross the border, 70% likelihood that you're going to get raped. I mean, it's a hard, tough journey. And yet people do it out of their human will to survive. And I think that we have to elevate the humanity. And also remember that migrants are essentially feeding us. I mean, let's look at agriculture. Let's look at the meat industry, even who's working in the restaurants. And so we can't be in this position where migrants are a core part of the labor force, and yet we can't extend basic human rights to them.
We were just talking about this the other day, about the importance of migrants in terms mm-hmm. of the workforce. You know, there was that
yes.
movie that was made, you take all the Latino workers out for one day mm-hmm. and, you know, Los Angeles was shut down and so forth. And certainly most would quickly concede that point. Wondering, though, when we have this really crisis going on now mm-hmm. with young people coming from
right.
Central America and trying to come to the country, many of them, you know, not only looking for opportunity here, mm-hmm. but trying to escape from violence.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. And you look at the problem and you see all the xenophobia that you're really mm-hmm. talking about, and racism and the scapegoating and everything. But then there's the other side of it. There are people who lose jobs. People who are here legally, who are displaced mm-hmm. by those who can work for less wages. And I just wonder what you say about, because I hear these arguments all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You have thousands and thousands of migrants coming into the country. What do we do about sustaining the future in terms of the revenue and taking that on, taking that additional expense on of people who often need aid and often need welfare and so forth, have to have education, et cetera, health care. And the other argument that you often hear, sort of in balance against the fact that, you know, we need the employment, we need these people, they're lifeblood to us and so forth, is, well, there are criminals who get through. There are people who are illegal, you know, and you get that argument constantly. The word undocumented says a great deal more than the use of the word illegal, but mm-hmm. people freely use the word illegal and they associate it with coming into the country not under legal prescriptions.
Well, I think first we have to take a hard look at foreign policy. I mean, in 1994, when NAFTA was passed, after NAFTA was passed, and we opened the doors for companies like Walmart and Monsanto to really go into Mexico and ecologically devastate the area, you had an increase in migration. You had an increase in poverty. NAFTA not only affected people in Mexico, it dramatically affected workers here. So first, I think that we need to really look at who we hold accountable. I think we need to stop looking at just migrants and really look at the policy decisions that are happening in our country and what are how
you say
is
look
it,
at the corporations.
Yeah, really look at corporations saying. And also look at politicians who are really pushing forward these free trade models, which are not only creating mass migration. I mean, migration is now a global phenomenon, but are creating mass poverty and are destroying the planet. And so I think that, yes, we are witnessing an influx of young people. What that also says is that we have to be good neighbors. We have to not just think about what's good for Americans. We have to understand that we are now in a globalized society and that we have to invest in the well-being of other countries and not just in economic terms, not just around crops, not just what works for big business.
But does that mean
people?
Open up our doors to whatever influx might come in? Because certainly in places like Mexico, they're not necessarily being open arms to those who want to come into their country.
Of course not. And, you know, I mean, right now Mexico, sadly, is going through a massive awakening because of the drug war. Well, you know, the guns that are coming to that have killed over 100,000 people in Mexico at this point are coming from the U.S. And so I think that what's required first is that we take a hard look at domestic and international policy. Second is that we understand that we do need a human rights frame to the laws. I don't think it's correct to just look at someone who crosses as a criminal, because often many of these women, over half of migrants are women and their children, and they're escaping very real violence. I mean, I believe that we have to look at them often as refugees. Many of these children that are 8 or 12 years old have already, you know, have undergone extreme brutality or have seen violence. And I think that we need a model to help them and support them and also be able to think about, well, how do we approach this as a problem in our hemisphere, right? That it's not just about them coming in. It's also about what is their trajectory? Like, what is the journey? Where can we look at why are they coming? And let's try to support them so that they don't have to come. I think it's extremely important also that people have the right to not migrate.
Talking with Fabiana Rodriguez, she's here with us in studio, artist and cultural organizer. And you say you want to change the culture, mm-hmm. you want to change attitudes. Mm-hmm. How would you do that, for example, or what are you thinking about? I know you've been very concerned about, as so many of us have, what happened in Ferguson, what happened mm-hmm. in New Jersey, and you know, the problem of concern about police tactics throughout the United States with young men of color. Mm-hmm. What to do, not only to get heightened awareness about those concerns, but also to maybe mobilize people?
Yes. Well, what I see happening now is an excellent example of how powerful culture can spread. And so you've seen now recently many sports celebrities, many basketball players have come out with T-shirts that say, "I can't breathe," right? Which is in reference to Eric Garner when he was in the chokehold before he died. He said, "I can't breathe," 11 times. Sports is also a part of culture. And so there's almost an awareness that's spreading, that's beginning with grassroots activists who are going out and who are really engaging in almost a performance art, because they're laying down their bodies, blocking traffic. They're creating a moral question, which is that police have not historically been here to, quote, protect us, and that actually we have to value the life of young black men and actually black women and transgender folks. I love the message Black Life Matters, Black Lives Matter, because I think that that's the essence of really what this is about, is that for us to think in our imagination, how is it that we value black life in our everyday actions? Like, for example,
how important is it to crystallize a message like
of
that?
Of course, because we are living in an age of such dehumanization of black men in particular and black people in particular, that we almost have to remind, these lives also matter. And you know, I've been hearing, of course, the people say all lives matter. But yes, of course, that's by default. But when you have a system that both has a legislative arm and a cultural arm, a systemic arm that has been very racist towards these lives, and that we really don't, you know, from Trayvon Martin to another young man who was shot when he was turning up the music, to the woman Renisha Brown in Detroit who was shot in the face. I mean, just blatant disregard for life. And I can assure you that were these young white kids, we would have a very different conversation in the media, even. And when I mean media, I mean mainstream media. The images that surround us of black people often are around criminality. They're around, they don't show black people in multidimensional roles. For example, when did you see a film, a sci-fi film or a film about dragons that featured black characters?
Well, unfortunately, there was The Cosby Show, and I say unfortunately,
oh, yes.
In the wake
yes.
of recent revelations. But,
right.
but certainly that was an attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're talking about media and you're talking about cultural attitudes, mm-hmm. and I know you mounted a campaign that actually mm-hmm. wound up with getting Lou Dobbs knocked off the
Correct.
Air. A lot of people don't even remember who Lou Dobbs was, but it had to do with what was perceived as his xenophobia and his
yes.
kind of immigrant baiting and all of that. There are people in the media who are far worse than Lou
Absolutely.
Dobbs.
Absolutely. I mean, yes.
Are we talking about maybe that as well? Kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, some people would get frightened when they hear purging the media of racists or of people who are demagogues, but there are a lot of them.
Yes, and we have to absolutely. There's two things that I think have to happen in the realm of culture. One is narrative correction. And that is that when you hear things that are absolutely just wrong, racist, sexist, when you hear hip-hop stars talk about how it's okay to drop drugs into a drink of a woman and then rape her, that's unacceptable. And that's this is what I talk about narrative creation, is that when you hear people in power who are able to broadcast their ideas and they say things that are incorrect, unethical, racist, or sexist, we have to call them out and we have to create public pressure to shame them. That's called narrative correction. I'm also interested very much as an artist in narrative.
Somebody might say political correction can be the slippery slope that you get into when you speak about narrative correction.
Well, I think that often these are the narratives that we hear. For example, when you had people like Rush Limbaugh talk about women as sluts, or when you have the presidents of some colleges say that, well, rape is actually just it's a human nature thing in young men.
I see a picture of you wearing a sign that said slut.
Yes.
I did.
Yes, I did.
I mean, it brings up another
point. Yes, I did.
It brings up another point because those women marched in yeah. Toronto when that Toronto police officer said something about, you know, they dress in ways that, you know,
right.
are slutty and so forth. And all these women went out and protested and wore signs like you did. Saying,
exactly.
But it kind of takes away from the power of that word to hurt.
Of course.
I mean, to put it out there, like people still call themselves queer, you know.
Yes.
For example, yeah?
And that's the power of culture, is that we're able to do controversial things that may make people uncomfortable. That's precisely the role, though, of art and culture, is to question the things that we assume to be embedded in our culture and actually to shame them. And so not only do I focus on narrative correction, I also focus on the creation of new narratives.
Well, you've mentioned, I think, things like the Laramie Project or
yes.
The Fruitvale movie. I
yes.
mean, as ways to move forward. Yeah?
Absolutely, because we should not only be reactionary and say, no, don't call me that. No, don't depict me like that. We also have to think about how do we create our own stories on our own terms that reflect the multidimensionality of who we are as human beings. Often, unfortunately, if I want to see a movie about a Latina woman, she's usually working in. I only see her as a domestic worker or as a gangster. Rarely do I see films about a complex Latina character who's empowered, who's, you know, running the world, or who's, you know, who's doing something that's really emboldened. And that, to me, I think is ultimately what I seek to do, is I want young girls, especially young girls of color, Latina girls, black girls, mixed girls, to see positive representations of themselves so that they can then, you know, dream about where they can be. If they're just depicted in very narrow ways, that affects our perception of ourselves.
I'm hearing in your voice the voice of my friend Rita Moreno, you know.
Oh, yes.
Famous actress, and
yes.
who has certainly made a strong case on the air here with me about just the lack or dearth of what you're talking about in terms
Absolutely.
Of those positive role models. You're involved in so many activist activities. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. social justice is the big banner here,
yes.
and so much of what you're committed to comes under that banner and so forth. Does it ever get frustrating? I mean, in the sense that, I'm not being heard and my art isn't being recognized and people aren't making the connections that I'm trying to make and I don't have the kind of, adherence or following that I would love to have?
Yeah, I don't as much get frustrated as I feel that We need to support more artists overall in our society. There was just a report that came out that the median income for working artists in the United States is $30,000 a year, which is really low wage
work. Why you can't
live
in the Bay Area anymore. Right?
Yes. Artists, as you know, are being displaced, not just from the Bay Area, from New York. Many major cities that were once art centers are no longer to be able to be that. And not just that, the recent report that came out said that working artists, which I define as artists who are able to work even part-time, make a living from their art, 4 out of 5 of them are white, overwhelmingly men. And so what this means is that there's cultural inequity happening, is that already we're already affected as communities of color are already affected by inequity overall. But if they want to be an artist, they have a very, very slight chance of being able to do that in a way that's economically sustainable. And this is both a reflection that the art world has traditionally left out and pushed out voices of color, but it's also, a reflection of economic inequity. And so I feel that it's important for us to tie these things together and not just view art and culture in a separate space. You know, art is a human right of every individual. Every individual has the right to be a critical thinker, to question, to have access to culture that depicts them, that helps them grow as human beings. And so it's appalling to me when I look at the art cuts. You know, art cuts predominantly happen in poor communities, predominantly in Latino and Black communities. When you look at how funding is dispersed, state of California, for example, Latinos make up 40% of the population, yet receive less than 2% of state arts funding. That's inequity. That means that we still have to make the case of why the way that arts is supported must reflect what the state looks like. And so I do, as an artist, I look at these things and I realize there's so much work to do. I really can't stop to be frustrated. Rather, I have to think creatively about how I, as an artist, can really leverage my platform and educate people on all of this.
Well, I want to remind listeners that you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and find a KQED Arts video of Faviana Rodriguez creating prints in her studio. She'll also be hosting an open studio this Saturday from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. at 1507 33rd Avenue in Oakland. And,
yes.
And you did that video with, I think it's in two parts, with Pharrell Williams, the Be Happy guy. And it's about migration. And that's available on YouTube.
Yeah, that's on YouTube. You can look up Migration is Beautiful. And it's actually a 3-part documentary about 2012, when I was traveling to Arizona, and then we went to the Democratic National Convention.
You made some noise there, and recently, yes, maybe we'll talk with you about this, traveling and your global travels to Sweden, to Peru, and to Mexico. Maybe talk about what all has been reap from that harvesting of travel. And we're also going to invite those of you listening to join us. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd like to hear from you. If you have questions or comments for our guest, Faviana Rodriguez, talking about cultural inequities, talking about activism and art and where they intersect, and talking about really a whole range of social justice issues, which she is strongly committed to, we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Oakland-based artist and social justice activist Faviana Rodriguez. It's part of our first-person series, which features innovators and leaders who make this Bay Area region so unique. And she'll be hosting an open studio this Saturday from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. at 1507 33rd Avenue in Oakland. You are cordially invited to that. And you're also cordially invited to see a video of her creating prints in her studio. It's on our website at kqed.org/forum. And you can also, of course, join this program by calling us at 866-733-6786 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Or you can also tweet us. And here's Alexis who tweets. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. She tweets, "Yes, we need to change culture to change politics. We need culture to represent our full humanity as people of color." So you may want to weigh in here, as Alexis did, and express your own sentiments. Before I go to your calls, though, and your emails, we were talking a little bit off air about some of Fabiana's travels, and she was in Sweden recently, as I said, and before we went to the break, as well as Mexico and Peru. And when I was in Sweden, I was struck by the separation of those who come from other countries or people of color and the Swedes. You know, and we had Jeff Chang on last week, who it turns out Fabiana Rodriguez knows, who's now head of the Innovation and Diversity Program at Stanford. And we were talking about how multiculturalism has really, I mean, at one time it was a banner, not only here, but in Europe. And in Europe, there's a lot of sense of defeat and failure because of just what we alluded to in terms of Sweden, the difficulty in this and the separation of populations and the unwillingness to bring them together, or the antipathy, really.
Yes, and I do believe that. I mean, in fact, multiculturalism, when I hear that word, I go,
You recoil a bit?
Yes, yeah. I recoil. And the reason is because representation is not enough. Tokenistic representation is not enough. Really, the question is power. Are we seeing a shift in power? Are we seeing equality? And when it's simply about including more people, that doesn't get to the root causes, and it certainly doesn't include a discussion on power shifting. And I think true equality is not just about representation. I mean, if we look at TV today, there's many TV shows that, you know, from George Lopez to black players in the NBA. That doesn't mean that we do not have a institutionalized racism in this country. So representation, while it's important, it's not enough on its own.
Well, it can be tokenism, obviously.
Absolutely.
Or it's just, you know, blacks have succeeded, African Americans extraordinarily, right, in basketball, for example, and things like that. But when you spread it out over institutional blankets throughout the country, throughout the world. Back to Europe, though, just for a minute, because the concern there seems to be with not only so much tokenism or anything, but there's a lot of fear.
Right.
And some of it perhaps is justified. There's fear that some of the, like in Sweden and places like that, Holland, that some of the Muslim population is going to move toward Sharia, that they're going to try to change what are more the traditions of Scandinavian or the Anglo-Saxon traditions and uproot them, really. Alter them, revolutionize them, even.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a cultural question. I mean, I think that often
it's a religious question too, though.
Yes. But it's also a question of shifting demographics. I mean, that's also happening here. Whereas that migration, which is a world phenomenon, I mean, there is billions of people moving every year, and with climate change, that's only going to increase. You're going to now have climate migrants that are going to be moving. I think that we are not taking into account, and governments especially are not understanding how this is shifting culture and how we deal with that. I mean, frankly, there's fear of the good old, of fearing of losing out on the good old days, without an understanding more of, well, how do we embrace change? How do we create systems so that many voices are counted? To me,
it's hard for people to embrace what they think Sharia is. We've had whole debates about what Sharia is, what it isn't. There's a lot of misunderstanding. But, you know, if, for example, people are to be flogged or beheaded or whatever, you know, in people's minds, that's just unacceptable.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, the reason I was actually in Sweden was to talk about migration in particular, because Europe, as not sure if you know, actually, but the number of deaths here in the last 14 years at the U.S.-Mexico border is about 6,000. In the Mediterranean Sea, it's over 20,000. So the influx of the risk that people are undertaking is extreme.
Just the number of lives that are lost from people trying to get out of North Africa into places like Italy. I mean, lost at sea, lost.
That's what I'm talking about. And it's affecting it's infecting all of Europe. And it's a question. I mean, the English are also saying, you know, that they're losing their English ways, that all of a sudden this influx. And I think that, again, we have to go back to questions of, well, why? I mean, we look at often the other, our fellow human being, as the creator of the problem, without looking at how our elected officials are augmenting to this and have actually created the conditions that force people to migrate, not to mention the wealth gap. I mean, at the global level, the wealth gap is only increasing. And I think it's important for people to say, hey, rather than rather than hate the other or feel that the other is taking away from me, let's look at the entire system and let's think, what are some laws that we can change? What are ways in which my government has created a condition where other people are forced to migrate, and what can be done through a foreign policy? Otherwise, we're not looking at the root causes. We're kind of looking at, you know, Band-Aids.
These are big questions.
Yeah.
Let's find out what our listeners have to say.
Great.
And have them join us. Jeff, you're first up here. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for allowing me to talk to you. And boy, you can sure articulate these issues so well. I really appreciate it. And also, can you give a little bit of a comment regarding the whole issue regarding immigration policy? It is so much like racial profiling because there are so many more people who are non-Latinos, who are non-Mexicans and South Americans who are also undocumented immigrants here.
Yes.
So that's not talked about.
Yes, that's correct. And this is, you know, part of changing culture is also changing ideas and challenging assumptions. I think that people, well, first, the New York Times article yesterday released information that said that Obama was going to announce new racial profiling laws, but that they did not apply to Border Patrol. And Border Patrol has jurisdiction over one third of the country because they can go in 100 miles from the border, and that they were going to be allowed to use racial profiling as a way to stop people. But yeah, and so there's this perception that, well, the Mexicans are somehow outsiders or that they are the ones who are immigrants. And we fail to recognize that we have, you know, the Filipinos. Filipinos are a huge undocumented migrant group. There's a lot of Africans. There's a lot of white migrants from Europe. And so part of the work that I'm involved in is in showing those stories of the white migrants, of the migrants from Nigeria, migrants from Iran, to show just the complexity of immigration law, of immigration overall, but also to show that, you know, it doesn't even matter if you're Canadian. My Canadian friends, it's practically impossible to get your papers here.
And you get many migrants from Iran?
Yes, there's migrants who are gay or people who come as undocumented and because of how they identify that are risking their life.
Did you say there were no black characters in science fiction? I didn't hear you say that. Because I'm looking at a comment on Facebook from a woman named Hannah who says, I couldn't believe your guest said there was no black characters in sci-fi. There are too many to list, male and female, villain and hero, movies and TV series I'll mention, Deep Space Nine, 100, Star Trek, Matrix, Men in Black, whole bunch of Will Smith movies, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes, I think that there is a lack overall, a lack of representation in terms of linking to our demographics. I think there's some examples, there's some exceptions, but I don't think it's the norm. I think that we need much more. And also,
well,
I mean,
didn't
they
say
are
anything
not
about science fiction.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I mentioned actually sci-fi and fantasy, but I think that what also is troubling to me is that we are often not the main protagonists, and just that overall, all the genres, whether it's comedy or film or love, romantic films, should be depicting stories of all people, not just, you know, I mean, if you look at even the romance films, it's rarely mixed couples. It's hardly people of color. I mean, it's often mostly white characters.
What do you think about President Obama's recent stance on immigration? You welcome it?
Yes, I welcome it because my community lives in fear. There's no reason why there should be the level of separation between families. There are over 1,100 deportations every day that are breaking up families. I mean, immigration law is broken. It's very broken. And both the Republicans and the Democrats can agree on that. I don't think it's enough. I think that it's, frankly, you know, I meet children who whose parents are facing deportation proceedings. There's a lot of money being made on incarcerating migrants. The system needs a more dramatic overhaul. And frankly, it's a shame that political football is being played between both parties where they say, no, you do it. No, you do it. And I don't think it's going far enough.
Let me bring another caller. David, you're on with us. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to start by mentioning that I'm married to an immigrant, so my children are 50% Guatemalan, and so I'm very sympathetic to the cause of immigrants. But I think what's frustrating for me is that so much of the conversation nowadays when this subject comes up is dominated by a lack of taking personal responsibility. And I guess my feelings on it are on a macro level and also on a micro level. On the macro level, this problem is never going to go away until Mexico deals with their issues down there. Most of the guys that work for me are Hispanic, and most of them do not want to go back, even if they're given the opportunity, because Mexico has become a horrible place.
Yeah.
And I just feel like there's this hypocrisy, and there's this, you know, from Peña Nieto to Vicente Fox, there's always this arrogance and hypocrisy about, America is so unaccepting and, you know, won't deal with this thing, but they won't even look at their own issues that's going down with all the gang wars, with all the people, you know, countless bodies of headless people.
Yeah.
They're buried in mass graves. And I wonder if the leak into America isn't a pressure relief valve that, if it wasn't afforded, would cause a revolution and cause them to deal with their own issues. But all I hear from your guest is a bunch of excuses that it's NAFTA and it's Monsanto and it's guns coming across the border, instead of taking personal ownership and saying, we want to get our act together. There's a constant flood across the border towards America, but I don't see it the other way around. That's an indicator. There's something wrong with Mexico. They need to get their act together. Maybe we can help them get their act together. But on the micro level, I also feel that with Hispanic people, my wife's family, they came over here illegally. They did it right. They were poor for years and years and years, but her brother ended up going to Berkeley. Now he's an engineer, very successful. They did it the right way. And the last issue I have is that so often in this argument, it's brought up that, well, we're a nation of immigrants. We're a nation of immigrants. Nobody can dispute that. But there's a key distinction. We're a nation of legal immigrants. You know, there is many of the issues that the Hispanics face today were faced by the Italians and the Irish and everything on the East Coast, but they came over legally, and now the Irish own the East Coast. Now Italians are, you know, they overcame these issues. So I don't think there's this exceptionalism or this special treatment that should be allotted for Latinos. They need to own their personal responsibility. Quit pointing to institutionalized racism. Quit pointing to NAFTA, to Monsanto, to all these other. What are you guys doing about doing it legally? There's something about when you start your relationship with a country or a municipality on a basis of breaking laws, it has an effect on your relationship, and you can't blame that on everybody else.
David, you brought up a lot of points here, and some of them quite salient. I want to get Fabiana's response, particularly about the distinction he makes between those who come here legally and those who come here, call it undocumented, illegal, whatever, but who don't have, shall we say, just the sanctity of being legal.
Yeah, well, the thing is, if it were easy to become legal or even accessible to be legal, then we would be talking about something different. However, right now, the visa backlog is 18 to 25 years. The condition. So even when people want to get in line or, you know, follow a process, the process is so broken that people are often waiting, you know, 25 years. And that's just, this is something that's been acknowledged by the president himself, which is that an immigration, overhaul of the entire system is required. Right now, if you want to get legal, it's practically impossible. You have to either marry an American citizen. You have to, which many people have to do now because there's no other way, or you can get in line and wait, you know, 25 years. Now, the problem is that if you're trying to escape violence, if you want to come be reunited, 25 years is simply not doable. What we're also witnessing is that, yes, I mean, Mexico, of course, needs to get its act together. But let's remember that the reason that there is a drug war right now is because of the American demand.
The appetite is here.
The appetite for drugs is here. And so we also, when we talk about personal responsibility, Americans need to take a hard look at what conditions we have created, the demand for drugs that has created a terror. A country where 80% of crimes go unsolved. Where
country people, which is really, for the most part, pervasively corrupt, and where 36
and it's our money
just disappear by probably being incinerated by a criminal drug gang. Let me thank the caller. And actually, here's somebody else who says, Fabiana says we need immigrant labor because, for example, most of the workers in the meatpacking industry are migrants from Mexico. What she ignores is the fact that wages in the meatpacking industry fell by half because of the availability of low-cost labor. Her thinking represents a triumph of wishful thinking over microeconomics.
Well, that's not entirely true. I mean, the reason that people were paid less is because corporations want to do factory farming. They began implementing systems where they said, no, we don't need unionized labor. We don't want to pay those union dues. We don't want to pay for sick pay. So why don't we hire people who are undocumented? And when they lose limbs, because as you may know, meat packing is one of the most dangerous jobs in the United States, they're going to go towards a population that's more vulnerable. And meanwhile, they are making record-breaking profits. And so again, I think that we need to pay attention to where the profiteering is happening, what decisions are being made at the level of governance of these corporations, these companies that are making decisions. I mean, the choice to go towards low-wage work.
Well, remember, our laws make it so that these corporations that you talk about are individuals under the law.
Individuals, and they get major subsidies for, they get tax loopholes. And so I don't think it's just a matter of blaming the worker. I think, on the contrary, we need to look at when NAFTA happened is the decrease in union jobs. We are now in a labor economy that's largely temp, low-wage work. That's not the fault of American workers. That's the fault of large corporations that have decided that profits are more important than Social Security, than pension plans. So I think yes, I don't think it's fair to just point at the workers.
Let me read a couple more listener comments, then we'll go to more of your calls. Here's a listener who says, your art about migration has made me look at the small migrations that happen in my community, the daily movement of children going to school, adults leaving for work, gardeners arriving to tend empty houses, maids arriving to clean empty houses and arriving to tend to children. Makes me question, if all these people trust their homes and families with immigrants, then why is there so much mistrust towards them? Another listener writes, this problem of artists not being able to support themselves is because we, most people, cannot afford art. We're trying to make ends meet, educate our children, pay for health care. Art is on the bottom of the list. It's a true shame, but that is how the world is right now. I have a daughter who wants to be an artist, and while I encourage her to pursue her dream, I'm hesitant because I know she won't be able to support herself.
Yes, that's very real. I mean, economic inequality is at an all-time high. And frankly, the majority, the grand majority of American families, families living in the United States, are struggling. And it's actually a worldwide problem. And so, yes, of course, I think art is important, but I also recognize that the times are such that we have to pay attention to other things. What
if
I
you
would
want
say,
to overcome social and economic inequality, do you have to be a social engineer? Do you have to come in and perhaps take from Peter to give to Paul and all of that?
No, I think, again, it's looking at we are living in times of inequality while we also have a growing, 1 or 2%. We have to look at how the wealth is being distributed and more say, you know what? How can, G&E and Bank of America and Citibank not pay their fair share of taxes? Or Walmart, for example, that's making the rate of $8.6 million a day.
Well, how about companies,
from American taxpayers?
Companies like Apple that set up an office in a foreign country and avoid paying taxes through perfectly legal loopholes.
And so I think that instead we have to look at the long term and say, how do we close these tax loopholes? This is our money. This is the people's money, and yet it's going to profits.
Here's a listener who says, how about reminding listeners how they can purchase her art online? I just checked her website. It's fabulous, Faviana.com.
Thank you.
Faviana, I love your story and your very accomplished work. It is vibrant and alive, and it is real art instead of propaganda. I have a huge collection of political posters from the 60s and 70s, so I've seen a lot of political artwork over the years, and I like yours much better.
Thank you.
Another listener says, how, pray tell, do we get our elected representatives to make laws that will change the conditions which force people to immigrate to the United States? The conditions that cause people to immigrate are created by other governments. That's what that other caller said, basically. But then this listener goes on to say, also, please don't let her off on the very real problem of immigrant-driven Sharia in Europe. It is a very real problem, and she should address it.
Yes, I don't think I have the expertise to address it, frankly. It's not something that I've researched entirely. So I'm not able to. Sorry, I'm not able to.
It is a major problem.
No, I agree. It's a complex.
I mean, the idea was to bring in people of all these different faiths from all over the world, have multiculturalism and so forth. But it's, you know, it's resulted in some real conflicts in terms of the law and public policy. Let me get Christina on here, though, our next caller. Hi, Christina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment, you know, towards the last caller, the gentleman who said that his wife is an immigrant and therefore he can speak on immigration issues. I think that's kind of the equal, that's the same level as saying, oh, well, I can tell a racist joke because I know this person of a, you know, different race. His view, I believe, on immigration as a whole, illegal or not, is, I think, very one, it's very narrow. I myself have been a benefit of the DACA program because of the fact that my parents really had no other choice but to come here. They tried to make it for about 20-something years and ended up having to go back because of the fact that the immigration system, there was absolutely no help or anything they could do to make their lives better, and in turn had to go back. Whereas myself, I've benefited quite fully from the new immigration reform that Obama has tried to do. And, you know, the problem is not, you can't just say that, oh, well, you have to do it legally. The people that say that, you know, I speak from experience, they haven't read all of the insane amounts of rules, little laws. It is a broken system. It's not something that just you can fill out a piece of paper and you can come over legally like you did back in the, you know, 1800s at Ellis Island with the Irish and Italian. The laws are much more complex, complicated. They've changed, and it's not something that's so simple to apply for something and, oh, you get it. And I think that, you know, spreading that type of view is very it's not helpful to the people that are in different circumstances, because it's not just from Mexico, it's from Guatemala, it's from Honduras, it's from all countries that are suffering from, you know, persecution from their governments or corruption for that matter.
All right, Christina, we thank you for the call. Appreciate you want to respond, Fabiana?
Yeah, I want to add that we have not had a major shift in immigration law since Reagan. Since 1986, it's been over 25 years since we have changed the laws. And so it's not that people don't want to follow a process. It's that there is no process. It hasn't been updated. And this is exactly the crux of the problem, is that if you haven't had a shift in laws in over 25 years, you have economic inequality that's creating a condition of forced migration. And we have 11.5 million undocumented people here, our families, our neighbors. Then we need to address it. And until lawmakers can really think this through, then we're going to have these Band-Aid solutions. I understand people's frustration, but again, I think that we have to look at the inaction that's happened by the people that we elect and hence created a problem for our families.
You have been involved, as we've made clear through the hour, in so much activist work, going back to youth coming out, work with violence against women. You called yourself a hardcore feminist. I mean, a lot of these certainly tie in together, and a lot of the work with migration has been paramount in many ways. I'm just wondering, is there a sense sometimes with triage, you know, in other words, where do I invest most of my energy when you can be spread out too thin?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, this past year, actually since 2012, when you had the onslaught of anti-abortion laws sweeping throughout the country, and at the same time, you have a rape crisis on campuses. You know, one in five women attending university will now be sexually assaulted. As a woman, I care about this very much, and I look at through my art, how is it that I can leverage what I do to really embolden young women so that they are not in these situations where they don't have agency over their bodies. Essentially, the issue with lack of birth control, the issue of abortion, or the fact that our access to abortion is decreasing, even though it's been 40 years since Roe versus Wade, and you have a rape problem, to me, it is a larger issue of how women are how women are treated and depicted in our culture, and also the laws designed around them. So yes, of course, I get a little spread thin, but at the same time, you know, I'm not just a Latina; I'm a woman. I'm also a working artist, and so all these things, I try to spend a little bit of time in all of them.
Una mujer con mucha energía. Here's another caller. Let me go to San Leandro. Murad, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wonder where your guest voice was from black against black crimes when they're killing each other in East Oakland. Why does Black Lives Matter right now all of a sudden to her? And the Filipinos are killing each other, or the Serenios killing the Norteños. You know, it's always a broken system when it fits her need. The immigration is a broken system. When I go to the DMV and I stand in line for an hour, to me, the DMV is a broken system. But I had to wait 11 years to get my visa to the United States. Why I had to wait? And somebody else that she thinks entitled to just come in and just, you know, without doing anything. Just take my answer on there and thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call, Mark.
Yeah, well, I think first, we don't say the word white-on-white violence. When you have massive shootings of mostly white men, the majority of mass shooters in this country are white men, shoot up colleges or shoot schools with elementary kids, kids at 6 years or younger, do we say this is white-on-white violence? No, we don't. And so I think just using the terms black-on-black violence...
I think he was suggesting, though, that maybe there's more value attributed to black life when it comes extinguished at the hands of police officers than when it happens within the black community.
Well, I think that we have the right to expect that the people that are empowered and that have this, you know, insane military gear and that, you know, are supposed to be protecting and serving, yes, when they are on killing rampages and you see the level of black death at what you do, then we have a systems problem. We have a problem.
They're really killing system. Rampages? I mean, these terribly isolated incidents that have occurred.
Well,
would the word rampage be appropriate?
You're right. Maybe that's not a great word, but just repetitive killings without consequences.
Fabiana, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And again, you can actually see her work by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. She creates prints in her studio, and it's on our website. And thank you for being with us this hour of Forum. It's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Senior editor is Dan Zold. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.